Let's talk about Father Christmas, why the heck he's in Narnia, and why J.R.R. Tolkien hated him so much. Welcome back to Talking Beasts. I'm Glumpuddle, going solo today. Holidays are hectic, so we decided to do something kind of simple, and Twigs had the idea, why not do something about Father Christmas? It's one of those things that we've never really done a full podcast about. We mentioned him in commentaries and other bits, but never done a full podcast about him, and hey, it is the season, so why not? But also, really quick, this will be our last podcast of the year. We're going to take a break after that. Probably we'll come back, you know, the next, you know, first couple months of 2018. But what we're going to do during that time is really try to figure out what can we do better on the podcast. So far, I've been doing this for about 8 months so far, the whole bi-weekly Talking Beast format, and we really want to go through what has worked and what hasn't. And to do that, we really need your help. So in the comment section below, please post this thing. Like, we just want to really get to know who's listening. So where do you listen? Is it on the way to work? Is it when you're at work? Do you have it on in the background as you're doing other things? Do you listen all in one sitting? Do you listen in a few sittings? And what do you like about it? You know, something as niche as Chronicles of Narnia, a podcast, you know, what are the things you like about it? And what are the things you wish we did more of? Positive and negative feedback, both very much equally appreciated. So please post that in the comment section below, or you can send an email to podcast@narniaweb.com. If you're listening to this podcast, I assume you read the Chronicles of Narnia, and therefore it's not a spoiler for me to say that Santa Claus shows up at some point, or Father Christmas, rather. And the first time I read this was a big curveball. This was, what's he doing there? And it took me a while to kind of figure out who it was and sort of settle into that. And I'd always assumed that was the case for, I get most or maybe all Narnia Webbers, that it's one of those things that took you a second to kind of get your head around. But I said, well, let me just check on this. So I asked a few Narnia Webbers recently. I walked up to them and just said, Santa Claus shows up in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. What was your first reaction? Did it seem weird?
It did not seem weird. I mean, I was like 7 or 8, and I was just like, oh, this is a cool story. They get presents. That's nice.
It was a bit strange at first, but it started to make sense the more I thought about it, I guess.
I probably just accepted it and went on. I was pretty young when I read the books, so I was elementary aged or younger. I just accepted whatever's in the story is in the story.
I've remembered the plot of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe since before I actually was able to read it. It's kind of like how everybody, you know, I grew up already knowing the twist in Star Wars because I saw it before I can actually remember. Same thing with Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I don't remember a time not knowing these things in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Well, the book was first read to me when I was in fourth grade. So as a fourth grader, I think I pretty much just rolled with it, like, why wouldn't Santa Claus be there? So my initial reaction was pretty cool. I personally was not raised to believe in Santa Claus. So for me, he just kind of fit into the whole fairy tale landscape of the story. So I wasn't too shocked that he was there.
Well, I always felt that transition was a little off, but I don't remember having a strong reaction to Father Christmas being there as if he was incongruous with the world. It was more just, wait, I thought the witch was chasing them and now she isn't.
Okay, maybe not. Maybe I'm the only one. And that's another thing for the comment section below. What was your first reaction when Father Christmas showed up the first time you read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? Was it as much of a curveball for you as it was for me, or did it just make perfect sense immediately? Maybe I just didn't get a very good sample here, so please post a comment below. But I do think that even in the way this scene is written, I think Lewis kind of indirectly acknowledges that, yeah, this is kind of weird. You know, I'm about to throw something at you that might seem out of place and might catch you off guard a little bit. He kind of eases you into the idea. So I'm going to read this bit from the book real quick. So we're at chapter 10 of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and Peter, Susan, and Lucy, along with the beavers, are on their way to the Stone Table to meet Aslan, and they're trying to go as stealthily as they can, and they spend the night in that cave for the beavers, the sort of hiding place that Mr. Beaver knew of. And then they hear the sound of bells, and they think it's the witch, and then no, it's not the witch. Here's an excerpt from chapter 10.
"Didn't I tell you," answered Mr. Beaver, "that she'd made it always winter and never Christmas? Didn't I tell you? Well, just come and see." And then they were all at the top and did see. It was a sledge, and it was a reindeer, with bells on the harness, but they were far bigger than the witch's reindeer, and they were not white, but brown, and on the sledge sat a person whom everyone knew the moment they set eyes on him. He was a huge man in a bright red robe, bright as holly berries, with a hood that had fur inside it and a great white beard that fell like a foamy waterfall over his chest. Everyone knew him because, though you see people of his sort only in Narnia, you see pictures of them and hear them talked about even in our world, the world on this side of the wardrobe door. But when you really see them in Narnia, it is rather different. Some of the pictures of Father Christmas in our world make him look only funny and jolly, but now that the children actually stood looking at him, they didn't find it quite like that. He was so big and so glad and so real that they all became quite still. They felt very glad, but also solemn. "I've come at last," said he. "She has kept me out for a long time, but I've got in at last. Aslan is on the move. The witch's magic is weakening." And Lucy felt through her that deep shiver of gladness, which you only get if you are being solemn and still.
I love that bit at the end about being solemn and quite still. I just think that just sums up the scene perfectly, and I think the movie captured that part of it pretty well. So obviously what's happening in the story here is we're seeing, you know, the White Witch made it always winter and never Christmas. So now we're, okay, Father Christmas is back. Oh, wow, it's Christmas. Well, that must mean the witch's magic is weakening. And I can certainly, you know, although there was that, I had that initial what with Father Christmas showing up, I have always liked the idea of what's happening to Narnia goes way beyond just, oh, now it's always winter. It's more than that. It's never Christmas. Because there's positive things we associate with winter as well, obviously Christmas being one of them, and hot cocoa and friends, and there's positive things about it too. And of course, in the Silver Chair, we have the Great Snow Dance. So the winter is not just all doom and gloom. But because the White Witch made it always winter, never Christmas, and you know how exactly does that work? Is not, you know, it doesn't actually make, that's definitely a child's logic again with this. Why can't they celebrate Christmas? Like, what's stopping them exactly? It's like the White Witch has done something to Narnia's soul. They can't have Christmas, and therefore can't have the joy of Christmas anymore. It's beyond just it's snowing all the time. So I like the fact that our first clue that the witch's magic is weakening is it's almost a spiritual awakening for Narnia first, and that's the signal. That's the signal that that Aslan is really on the move. But the way Lewis kind of sets this up, I think he is kind of acknowledging, yeah, I'm about to throw you a curveball. He reminds you of the book you're reading. He reminds you of the world that you're in, which is kind of the one-sentence summary of Narnia I've always gone to. It's a place where myths are real, or maybe things that we wish were true, they actually are true in Narnia. But he sets up this idea of, let me find it here. He says, everyone knew him because though you see people of his sort only in Narnia, you see pictures of them and hear them talked about even in our world. So it's kind of this, okay, we've got fauns, we've got, you know, centaurs and all these other things. Why not Father Christmas? It's a bit of a leap in, it's a bit of a child leap in logic, just a little bit to kind of lump all those things together, but I think it does work. I like that kind of child logic. So it's one of the things I've come to really like a lot about the series that initially was a curveball. But this is the first book, of course, make no mistake. Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is the first book to be published. Also, that we're still kind of getting my head around what's the world we're in and what are the rules. And so this Father Christmas, this is a really important moment. This is the kind of thing that would only happen in Narnia, would not happen in something like Lord of the Rings. And by the way, of course, J.R.R. Tolkien hated this. In general, he didn't like the Chronicles of Narnia. Lewis, of course, loved Lord of the Rings, and very possibly, if not for Lewis's encouragement, the Lord of the Rings would not have been published at all. But Narnia, on the other hand, Tolkien hated Narnia. One of the reasons he hated it was Lewis mixed mythologies. Tolkien wanted them all kept separate. Lewis had a lot of fun. He made this mythological soup called Narnia and just mixed everything together. So if you're like Tolkien, if you're a mythic purist, I can imagine you're kind of annoyed with the very idea, the world we're in right now. You're not loving the book as it is. And then you throw Father Christmas on top of that? Are you kidding me? I can totally, you know, see coming from Tolkien's perspective why he would hate that. And even from, just a regular reader's perspective, I think it is, it does seem like a little bit out of place. But it's one of the things that, because it's a curveball, it's really challenged me to think about Narnia. Like, what am I reading right now? What is this world I'm in? Why is Father Christmas there? And we kind of talked about this in the previous podcast about Susan and why she's absent in the last battle. And it's one of the things that really made me, since it was such a curveball, really made me think about the series more deeply. And in this case, the idea of mixing mythologies, this idea that ultimately all these myths come from the same place. Now, in the book we're reading, Chronicles of Narnia, they literally all come from the literally all come from the same place. They do exist in Narnia, and we just heard rumors of them. But I kind of wonder if Lewis is getting at something even, suggesting something even deeper than that. We see throughout the series this theme of longing and characters that feel alienated from the world that they're in. They want something more. They want something beyond the world, the most famous example being Reepicheep. He loves his sword. He loves death, battles, and honor and all that. He really believes in all that. But the moment he gets to Asen's country and gets to the world's end, he throws his sword away. And he says, "Won't it be worth anything to get one glimpse of the world's end?" Caspian, of course, even though he's a prince, has anything you could want. He says, "Oh, I wish I could have lived in the old days." When Jill the unicorn gets to the real Narnia, Jill comes running to the door and says, "I've come here at last. This is the place I've been longing for, even though I didn't know it." Things like, you know, Shasta knew in his bones that I was made for something more than this. I wasn't just made to be a fisherman's son. I was made for something more than this. The world I'm in right now, it's not enough. There's something more. I was made for something bigger than this. Diggory wanted a cure for his mother. Anyway, I could go on and on of, you know, the characters that they're not, the world that they're in, it's not enough. They need something more. That's one of the unifying themes that unites the Chronicles of Narnia. And what is Narnia? A place where myths are real. So it's hard not to connect those ideas, I think, and say, is there a reason? And just ask the question, is there a reason humans want to invent? Is there a reason we want to invent things that don't exist and couldn't exist? Why do we keep doing that? There's a huge industry in our world revolving around people who can create stuff that doesn't exist and couldn't exist. Why is that? Why do we eat it up? And so I think that's what kind of what Lewis is asking is, why do people want to reach for something beyond the world? Why is this world just not enough? Why is that? It doesn't make sense. Why is that? Post a comment. Tell me what you think. Do you think that that's what Lewis is getting at? Do you agree with that kind of assessment of humanity, that that's what's going on? And what do you think the answer is? So I've always found that really, really interesting. So that's something where Father Christmas, curveball initially, but the more you think, the more I think about it, the more it definitely rewards rethinking and reanalyzing. And so for that reason, it's become curveball at first, but become one of my favorite scenes in the series. And I love the gift giving. It's kind of the transformation of the kids from kind of regular kids. They're still regular kids, but kind of regular people into almost mythological characters. The fact that they get the sword, the bow and arrow, Lucy gets her dagger, which Lewis later seemed to kind of forget about. Dagger never does come back, but her cordial and Susan's horn. I wish Susan's horn had been used even more. And the beavers get their, what is it? It's a new sluice gate for Mr. Beaver and a sewing machine for Mrs. Beaver. Anyway, tangent. The point is that it's almost as the kids get their weapons, we realize, oh, they're going to fight and they're going to become kings and queens. And I think that's almost the transformation into almost mythological characters. And even in the battle and when they're being crowned kings and queens, I never really question it. Getting, you know, 8 to 14-year-olds fighting and being kings and queens, I just find myself not really questioning that, amazingly. And I think this scene is kind of the beginning of that transformation. Director Andrew Adamson, in adapting this Father Christmas scene, he actually thought about cutting it out. It would have been really easy to do. Adamson actually toyed with that idea, and he talks about the challenge of adapting this scene in the director's commentary for The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Even as a child, when I read the book, I remember getting to the bit where we see Father Christmas in the book and flipping back a page and reading again and just kind of going, you know, what is he doing here? And we had a lot of discussion early on about whether he should be in the movie or not. In previous iterations in the animated version of this film that they made in the 70s, he wasn't in the film. And I think it's because he is relatively incongruous. But in doing a bit of research, I really found that C.S. Lewis and Tolkien nearly ended their friendship over this. That C.S. Lewis really strongly felt that Father Christmas belonged here, and Tolkien didn't think he did. And C.S. Lewis stuck with it despite the fact. So I didn't really feel it was up to me to cut it out. I felt it was was up to us to find a way to make it work. And I think ultimately it was James Cosmo that made it work, because he's just so sincere and has such gravitas that he really pulls it off as this real kind of wise oracle character.
And I had pointed out that to an American audience, certainly a young American audience, they will not know initially who this man is, because we don't have the concept of Father Christmas. We have a Santa Claus and who has a different costume, a big red suit. And yet, soon enough, you figure out that, of course, it is Santa Claus. Here he is now with a bag full of presents, and you pick it up. So initially, you're not sure who it is. We've actually had one or two people, when we were testing the film, look at it, and those who hadn't read the book and didn't know who Aslan was, think for a moment that perhaps he's Aslan. And I think it was you, Andrew, who said, I'm not so sure if there is that confusion, if that's a bad thing.
No, I like the idea. I was always worried, because in the book, Aslan is revealed to be a lion fairly early on, and I wanted to give it a bit more impact by making it a surprise. And to me, that means it's successful, that we've got a movie called The Lion, The Witch and the Wardrobe, but still have people not knowing necessarily that Aslan is a lion, so that he has a lot more impact when he shows up.
So this is a case where I think that Adamson saw this as a challenging scene to adapt. And part of it, it's just something that's so uniquely Narnia. You wouldn't do this in Lord of the Rings. You know, like this is something that really is kind of unique to Narnia. That made it kind of challenging. And I think the fact that he said, no, we need to stay with this, what we ended up with is something that's, I think, one of the best scenes in the movie, one of the most memorable, and one of the few things in the movies that's like, wow, that really stands out as something kind of special. So to me, that just speaks to, if something is really difficult to get right, it might be because so few people have really tried it, in which case there's an opportunity here to do something really, really memorable and really, really unique. You might be that usually ends up being the best stuff in a movie. So I love the fact that Adamson persisted and said we've got to find a way to make this work, even though it's challenging. And I think he got something really, really memorable out of it. So many ways this could have derailed the movie, to suddenly have Santa Claus show up. I think it could have derailed the movie so much that it just would not have been able to recover if they had got it wrong. But I think they got it really, really right. A big part of it is James Cosmo's performance as Father Christmas. There's a hint of the jolliness in there, I think, if you watch his performance. Just a hint of the Santa Claus that you and I know. But there's a solemnness. You know, Lewis uses that word solemn a few times in this part of the book. And I think that comes through in James Cosmo's performance. And there's a real sense of history to his performance. You feel that sense that he knows things that he's not letting on. He really feels like a real character. They really went to great pains, I think, to really make him feel real. And I think the costume is great too. Like it's got some red and green in there, but they kind of pull it back a little bit, so he feels like the real version of the mythical character. Really, the only thing about the scene I don't like is that one line where they credit the melting snow to the kids rather than Aslan.
I thought there was no Christmas in Narnia.
No, not for a long time. But the hope that you have brought, your Majesties, is finally starting to weaken the witch's power.
That, I think, kind of waters down what makes the scene so... One of the things that makes it so magical in the book, which is that we've been hearing about Aslan the entire book. We saw the kids react to his name. We learn he's a lion. We start learning more about him bit by bit. We see the witch's reaction. Oh my gosh, she completely freaks out when she hears the name. And this is the first real evidence, like kind of tangible piece of evidence of Aslan that we've seen so far. So it's by the time we meet Aslan, he's been hyped up for a while. But to see such evidence of Aslan's power, oh my gosh, the snow melting, and also Christmas is back. Wow, you know, that's just a great setup for the character. So I think by having it be the kids, I think it kind of waters down that excitement of getting to meet Aslan a lot. So it's really just that one line is the only issue I have with it. Speaking of the movies, I was talking with Narnie Wibber Melton Talley yesterday, and we kind of stumbled upon this idea of what if you had Father Christmas in future Narnie movies, like The Silver Chair, for example. And my first reaction to that thought is, no, of course not. But then my second thought is, well, why not? Well, why couldn't you have Father Christmas, for example, at the Great Snow Dance in the Silver Chair? Maybe it's probably not in there in the book because it'd be too distracting. It doesn't serve anything at this point. But I don't know, Lewis never did anything more with it. But what if you did do more with Father Christmas in future Narnia movies? I don't know. Post a comment. Tell me what you think of that idea. I just wanted to throw that out there. So thanks so much for listening. I'm going to wrap this up in a second. Got a few things for the comments section, and one of them is... I'm going to try to stump some Narnia Webbers. Yes, plural. I'm going to try to stump you. Just post your answer to this trivia question in the comments section. So, listener, your stump question is, which book by C.S. Lewis was dedicated to J.R.R. Tolkien? Which of Lewis's books was dedicated to Tolkien? If you know the answer, post the answer in the comments section. Also for the comments section, post, again, what was your first reaction to Father Christmas when he appeared? Was it as much of a curveball for you as it was for me? And then, of course, feedback about the podcast. Just, you know, why do you like the podcast? What could be better? Just some general feedback, good or bad. You know, we actually very early on when we started doing this biweekly thing, we got a really long, really well-written piece of feedback that was largely negative and very much appreciated. We learned a lot from it, and we actually did change the podcast accordingly in a lot of places. So please let us know what you think of the podcast and how we can serve you better. That is it for now. We will be back sometime early next year after taking a look at your feedback. Thanks for listening. Merry Christmas, and long live the true king.